95.9 FM CKUW Winnipeg is pleased to present you with this special broadcast. On June 20th, 2003, as part of the National Campus and Community Radio Conference, CKUW presented Amy Goodman at the University of Winnipeg. Amy Goodman is best known as the anchor and executive producer of Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! She has also co-produced the award-winning documentaries Massacre, The Story of East Timor, as well as Drilling and Killing, Chevron and Nigeria's Oil Dictatorship.
Thanks very much. It is really great to be here in Winnipeg. I want to thank the National Campus and Community Radio Association, the staff and volunteers and listeners at CKUW 95.9 FM here in Winnipeg, Art Ladd and Rob Schmidt. Also want to welcome CJSF. I see Frieda Worden, the new immigrant to Canada up there at Simon Fraser University in Burnaby, British Columbia, who began carrying Democracy Now! Just recently, and we welcome you. We also hear that CFUV in Victoria is also beginning to carry us, and we occasionally, and we encourage all the representatives of the conference here to consider carrying Democracy Now! It is a really remarkable endeavor that began 7 years ago that has become the largest public media collaboration in the United States. We're now airing on 140 radio and public access TV stations, community radio, Pacifica, NPR stations, as well as on the internet and on satellite TV, Dish Network. It's Free Speech TV, Channel 9415. And it is absolutely critical in the face of media concentration now for us all to join together, because these media moguls are getting more and more power and they are gobbling up the smaller stations. There was the experience recently in Minot, North Dakota, in January 2002, a freezing cold morning, when a train derailed and there was ammonia gas release. And the authorities wanted to let the residents know what had happened. There were six radio stations in town, all owned by Clear Channel. Clear Channel Corporation in the United States, in the last few years, has grown from several dozen stations to more than 1,200 stations. So they owned all the stations in Minot, and the authorities tried to get the one worker for the six stations, who they could not find, the news employee. There were these six stations clear channeling music from another state, and 300 people ended up going to the hospital, and they were not able to break into the broadcasts. The whole issue of community media, of local media, grassroots media, is being severely challenged in the United States, but people are fighting back, and you may have heard the news just yesterday. This morning we reported on Democracy Now! We've been doing extensive coverage of the Federal Communications Commission. It was interesting to listen to Alexander Coburn in the video referring to it, and that was a long time ago. But you have the commission we have in the United States that is supposed to regulate the media, and now sees its key role is to deregulate the media, run by Michael Powell, yes, son of Colin Powell, the general and secretary of state who led the war on Iraq. His son Michael leads the war on diversity of voices in the media. He tried to ensure that very few people would find out about what the FCC's agenda was, setting June 2nd as the deadline where they released these rulings that would allow networks to reach almost half of an audience, one network, like Fox's Murdoch, like Murdoch's Fox or Viacom, which owns CBS in the United States. And it's a very simple equation. You have these huge corporations, some of the most powerful on earth, that grease the wheels and pocketbooks of the politicians in Washington. And then they in turn do their bidding and they deregulate whatever is left of the regulations. Well, Michael Powell did manage to put through these rulings on June 2nd. But because of community media, particularly Pacifica Radio, that broadcast his one hearing in Richmond, Virginia, which he tried not to let anyone know about in the midst of a snowstorm in the dead of winter. But the two dissident commissioners among the five altogether decided to buck the establishment and held informal hearings around the country. And we were at almost all of them, broadcasting the voices of community groups and unions and, well, a cross-section of American society. It was amazing. From the National Rifle Association to Code Pink, all of these groups were opposed to media deregulation, the idea that one media mogul could own all of the media in a town. And just yesterday, in the U.S. Senate, from Republican racist Trent Lott of Mississippi, the former majority leader, to Democratic California Senator Barbara Boxer, they have voted to turn back some of these regulations, seeing full well in this election year that the FCC was inundated with almost a million emails, calls, responses from people around the country. It didn't matter the people's political persuasion. They were almost all, more than 99% of them, were opposed to media consolidation. And Michael Powell has been reversed at least at this point. It now goes to the full Senate and to the House of Representatives. But since so many in the House are beholden to the National Rifle Association, we may have a very good chance at rolling this all back. It is up to community media, and not only in the United States and Canada as well, joining together to ensure that that full diversity of voices on so many different issues, on the most important issues of our day, life and death, war and peace issues, are heard. It's up to us. I come from Pacifica Radio, which was founded more than 50 years ago in 1949 by a man named Lou Hill in Berkeley, California. He refused to fight in World War II, and when he came out of the detention camps, he said there has to be a media outlet that's not run by corporations that beat the drums for war because they profit from war, but run by journalists and artists. And that's how Pacifica Radio was born, first station KPFA. FM was in its infancy at the time. And so KPFA had first to give out radios so that people could hear the station, FM radios. And then they would ask people to call in and pledge support. We pioneered the whole idea of listener sponsorship, which is now very common in the United States for public radio and television to have fundraising drives. And I know that you have it here as well, where people call in and pledge support. And that's the honest way to do it, not to make slick backroom deals with corporations. That is, George Gerbner, founder of the Cultural Environment Movement, says, corporations with nothing to tell and everything to sell that are raising our children today. But instead, run by people like you, run by the community. And that is the most honest media. That is media serving a democratic society. That's how we began. KPFA in Berkeley, KPFK in Los Angeles, in Washington, WPFW in New York, where I come from, WBAI, and in Houston, went on the air in 1970, KPFT. It's the only radio station, KPFT, to be blown up in the United States. It was blown up in its first year of operation by the Ku Klux Klan. And when the Grand Dragon went on trial, he said it was his proudest act, because he understood how dangerous Pacifica is. Dangerous to hate groups like his, because the whole legacy of Pacifica is to provide a forum for people to speak for themselves. And when you hear someone describing their own experience, it breaks down bigotry, hatred, caricatures, stereotypes. You can begin to identify. And those are the emotions, the hatred and the bigotry that fuel groups like the KKK. And that's why community media is so important. We remain today the only independent media network in the United States. We don't take any corporate underwriting. We don't take any advertising. And so that was Pacifica in the 1940s, 50s, 60s, 70s. That's how we began. I always like to use an example when talking about independent media of another independent journalist at the dawn of the nuclear age named Wilfred Burchett. And maybe some of you have heard of him. But he covered the aftermath of the bombing of Hiroshima. When the rest of the media went to a barge off of Japan to cover the surrender, he got in a train and traveled for 30 hours to Hiroshima to see what had happened, to understand what this new weapon was all about. When he got out of the train, he was horrified. Obviously, had never seen anything like it. He didn't have the words. He said, there is a kind of bomb sickness, atomic sickness here. He saw people, he saw the shadows of people engraved in the walls of buildings. He saw people running with their skin melting off. And he sat down in the midst of the rubble with his Hermes typewriter, and he tapped out the words, I write this as a warning to the world. Another reporter got into Hiroshima just after Wilfred Burchett. His name was William L. Lawrence, and he was reporting for the New York Times. He did a series of six pieces. One of the headlines, no radiation sickness, no bomb sickness found at Hiroshima. He won the Pulitzer Prize for his reporting. It later turned out he was also on the payroll of the Pentagon. We need independence in media. We need media that is not towing the line for corporations that profit from the misery of others. Jumping forward to the Persian Gulf War, to 1990 and 1991, at that time, CBS was owned by Westinghouse. NBC was owned by General Electric. These are two of the major nuclear weapons manufacturers in the world. Was it any surprise that what we saw then on television was basically a military hardware show? No, that's not what war looks like. And now they've refined it even further with the latest invasion of Iraq. The most remarkable relationship has developed and deepened with the embedded reporters, not to be confused with those reporters in bed with the military. They couldn't have come up with a better word. Michael Moore recently spoke in New York, you know, author of Stupid White Men and Other Sorry Excuses for the State of the Nation. He had just won the Academy Award and criticized Bush in his Academy Award acceptance speech. And maybe some of you who listen to Democracy Now! Here got a chance to hear what he had to say or watched it on TV. But when he came back that week from the Academy Awards, he came out to a big event we had for WBAI at Riverside Church, the historic Harlem church in New York. And he said he called on the withdrawal of troops from NBC, CBS, and ABC. It is amazing now. We watch on CNN the generals who are on the payroll of the networks questioning the embeds out in the field. So you have Wesley Clark questioning people like, well, my colleague Jeremy Scale thought they originally said our terrorist. They said Art Harris, but Art Harris. And now we go to our terrorist in the field. And you have Wesley Clark saying, what do you see there? And you have the reporters responding, yes, sir, no, sir. And this is our media. You have MSNBC and NBC, as well as Fox, all trying to out-Fox Fox, but all of them, name their coverage of the invasion of Iraq the same thing that the Pentagon called it, Operation Iraqi Freedom. That's incorporated into their logo. And when you see that, you have to ask, if we had state media in the United States, how would it be any different? Operation Iraqi Freedom. I just wish the Pentagon had stuck with its original name for the invasion, which was, well, Alexander Coburn reported it in Counterpunch, Operation Iraqi Liberation. It's acronym OIL, oil. But they realized it. Yes, they could spell, unlike perhaps the resident in Washington. And they changed it to Operation Iraqi Freedom. And you think about the coverage there. You have the argument that they present, well, how would you get that kind of frontline coverage if you didn't have the embeds? Well, if you're going to have reporters embedded with the military, why not have a reporter embedded with an Iraqi family? Instead of just showing those grainy video game images of a target from above, shouldn't reporters be there on the ground, what it feels like to be that target? Shouldn't there be reporters embedded in the peace movement to let us know what that movement is that bellowed around the world on February 15th, all over Canada, all over Europe, Africa, Asia, the United States, when 30 million people said no to war? Yes, George Bush has united the world against him. It's absolutely remarkable. When we were in Washington for the major protests, the first protest in October was very significant. 100,000 to 200,000 people came out in Washington, D.C. The New York Times reported the next day there were a couple thousand people, which was very disappointing, they said, especially for the organizers, even though the sun had come out. The question was the reporter there? No, it wasn't Jason Blair who was covering that story, but in fact, the reporter was not there, though there were interviews done with a couple of the couple of people who were out there. Pacifica was there broadcasting live nationally, as was C-SPAN, and people could see there were many more than that. The police told us between 150 and 200,000. So we decided to dissect the Times coverage. Our reporter, Mike Burke, said after he read the story, I don't believe that the reporter actually interviewed these people at the protest. I said, how can you tell? He said, I just don't think so. So he tracked down each person interviewed in the New York Times. It was a professor at MIT, student at the University of North Carolina, and the organization MoveOn. And the guy at MoveOn said, no, she didn't interview me there. She interviewed me a few days before. The person from MIT said, no, she didn't interview me there. And the student said, she did interview me there, the reporter, on my cell phone. She called up and said, I asked her why she wasn't here, and she said she was working on another story. She was working on the sniper story at the time, because the New York Times only has one reporter and they cover all the issues. And of course, you know, they have much more, but it's a matter of where they decide to spend their resources. Interestingly enough, after we did this piece, and it was pretty straightforward what they had done, simply not told the truth, she did call us, though she wasn't willing to come on at the time, and she said she had called the editors later that day, even though she wasn't at the protest, and she said the numbers are much bigger than I had estimated, but they refused to change the numbers. We called an editor because a few days later, it was very unusual, the New York Times did another story on the same protest, and it said 100 to 200,000 people were there. It was a big story with a big photograph, and it said that the organizers were overwhelmed by the numbers. They said that they had taken out a permit for 20,000 people and expected 30 buses, and more than 650 buses came from as far away as Nebraska. So our question was, who do you believe, the New York Times or the New York Times? So we called an editor and said, well, why didn't you also put in a correction? You know, everyone reads the little correction columns when you get a date wrong or a middle initial wrong. That's the kind of things that they correct. Why didn't you correct? You know, you said a couple thousand people came, the organizers were disappointed, and 3 days later, the 100 to 200,000 people and the organizers were overwhelmed. And he said, because we didn't make a mistake. Well, what do you call it then? He said, a different perspective. So the next time you ask your kid, did you spill the milk? And he says, no. And you say, tell the truth. And your child says, I'm just sharing a different perspective. They're learning from the paper of record. And you have the New York Times now saying that they have reached an all-time low. Howell no longer reigns. Well, Howell Raines was the head of the New York Times, and he resigned. And I don't know how much you follow the politics of the Times, but they did a huge expose on themselves on a reporter named Jason Blair, 27 years old, who had basically conned them and falsified a lot of reports. And they said they're at an all-time low in their paper, 152 years. And I do think they are at an all-time low. But it's not because of the Blair affair. It's because of the Bush-Blair affair. It is because of their drumbeat for war. And it is not only the New York Times. It is all of the corporate media in the United States absolutely shamelessly cheerleading for war. Fairness and Accuracy in Reporting did a study of the week leading up to Colin Powell making his case for war at the UN Security Council on February 5th, the week leading up to it and the week after it. More than half the people in the United States were opposed to the invasion at that time. They looked at the four major network newscasts of those 2 weeks. There were 393 interviews done around the issue of war. Three were with people opposed to war. Three of almost 400 interviews. Now, that is not a media that is serving a democratic society, presenting a diversity of views, and it matters. Yes, it matters much more than that young man that misreported that there were red, white, and blue daisies or pansies outside someone's house, and or that there were tobacco fields in front of another house because he hadn't really gone, that young reporter that they fired. What mattered were the front page pieces of people like Judith Miller, exclusive based on unnamed sources that said that Saddam Hussein had weapons of mass destruction, that he was buying uranium, for example, from Niger. Yes, then you had this odd situation where it was unnamed sources from the government, where she would simply further the government line, never substantiated, now proved to be untrue. And then the government would say, it's not only us who's saying this, look at the New York Times. And the New York Times would be sourcing them, or not naming their sources. Now, these are the stories that matter, that take lives. These are the most dangerous stories, and this is why our media in the United States has reached an all-time low and must be exposed for what it has done. There were people who were embedded with Iraqi families who wanted to give a different perspective, to let us know what it feels like to be the target of the most powerful military on earth. It's absolutely critical that reporters do that, but also that reporters report on those that risk their lives. And I had the unusual experience just today, about an hour ago, when I flew into Winnipeg. When I came out through customs, there were a few cameras that were there. And they were waiting for a young woman, I believe her name was Lisa Martins, and she has just returned from Iraq, having been, in a sense, I guess you could say, embedded there, part of the Christian peace teams. And I thought for a second we can just pull down the screen, and you can hear what she has to say. This is just an hour ago when she arrived here at Winnipeg Airport. I just took out my camera. I was quite shocked. And another man named David, I forgot his last name, I bet some of you know him, from the Mennonite Church, is headed to Iraq on Monday to bring $2.5 million worth of aid to the people of Iraq. You get a preview of what we'll be playing on Monday on Democracy Now!
First, I want to say thank you so much for being here and the work that you're doing to support Iraqi people and that you have been doing and that you're continuing to do. It's really great. An Iraqi bishop, Catholic bishop, Warduni, said recently when I was visiting him that one of the reasons that during the chaos of the war that Muslims and Christians didn't have as conflictive a relationship as they might have was because Muslims understood that Christians around the world are supporting Iraqi people in general. And so it really does help, you know, it according to his opinion, reduced, you know, the civil unrest and the civil conflicts that could have happened. So it's a good thing. Sorry, my brain's a little bit fried after the long trip, so I'll take a little while to start things up. Yeah, it's kind of crazy. I mean, millions of us were praying and working and everything against the war, and the war happened, and so that's pretty sad and kind of discouraging. Probably the vast majority of the world's population was against the war, but it still happened. So I was thinking about that a lot, and one thing I was thinking about was this Iraqi judge that I met in Basra. And he helped me think about it. He was 2 years in jail under Saddam Hussein for critiquing Saddam Hussein. So he's a very outspoken critic even in the 80s. And he also is right now living in a house where four houses around him have been bombed to rubble, and 23 of his neighbors were bombed to death. Supposedly, the coalition forces were trying to bomb Chemical Ali. I don't think they found him there, but they killed 23 civilians. And something that he said out of all his experiences was that Saddam had been a little monster, and U.S. and Britain and Russia made him into a big monster. And I think that's something that's kind of affected the way I think about this, because in the 80s, the U.S. was supplying weapons to Saddam Hussein, and Kurds and Iranians were dying horrible deaths from the chemical weapons that Saddam was using against them, and the U.S. didn't really make a peep about it. And so, and then years later, they started bombing Iraq and stuff, saying that it was for those reasons. And so I think we really have to look to the roots of that kind of thing. And I was thinking about this, and it might sound simplistic, but, you know, in terms of how we can try to reduce violence in the future, maybe part of it is for the millions of people that are against the war to help stop paying for the war. So for U.S. folks to not be paying their military taxes when they hear that weapons are going to little monsters, so that you prevent the whole problem in the first place. And secondly, you know, I don't know what kind of things. I mean, Canadians are creative. We can think of things to boycott that would pressure economically. I think maybe touching the economics can help in the future and can even help in the situation as it unveils, as the oil ministry is very well protected right now in Iraq, while hospitals are still struggling a lot. And you see a lot of mixed priorities there.
But there she is, Lisa Martins of the Christian Peace Team. And it's very important, in addition to showing soldiers coming home, to also show the people like Lisa, who got very little coverage, who were there, who were incredibly brave, and who continue to go there. And that's why we need independent grassroots media that do chronicle the peace movement and that provide hope to many, many people. Coming here has also been very interesting. On this day in Winnipeg history, just picking up the paper, where this morning an immigrant who has laid in a pauper's grave in Winnipeg finally got a headstone and a name on his grave. The little-known Winnipeg immigrant who became a symbol of the brutality of the 1919 general strike will finally get a headstone for his grave. For the last 84 years, the body of Mike Sokolowski, 40 years old, has lain in an unmarked grave at Brookside Cemetery, only the graveyard staff aware of his numbered plot in the paupered area. On June 21st, this the anniversary, tomorrow, 1919, Sokolowski, a Ukrainian immigrant, found himself at the center of a huge demonstration of strikers in Market Square. Federal troops quelled the uprising by opening fire, and they killed him. And so now Mike Sokolowski has a name. He's being recognized. And this morning at 11 o'clock, maybe someone here was there, representatives from the communities considered enemy aliens in 1919, Ukrainians, Poles, Jews, Germans, and Austrians were on hand to take part in the unveiling to honor Sokolowski and the role of immigrants in Winnipeg's history. And immigrants today in Canada, in the United States, are at the center of a firestorm and an increasing crackdown, which is why it is incumbent on all of us to stand up, because it is much harder to isolate people when we're all standing around them. I always say I believe the role of media, of community media, is to make dissent commonplace, so that when someone hears someone express a dissident point of view as they get up to go to the water cooler at work, they're not alarmed. They don't report this comment. They don't think that it is subversive, but actually at the foundation of our countries, the idea of being able to express your point of view. I come from New York and a small firehouse in Chinatown, which is just blocks from Ground Zero. On that morning, on September 11th, 2001, the first plane hit the first tower of the World Trade Center at 8:47 in the morning. Democracy Now! Broadcasts at 9 o'clock, a few minutes later. We were right nearby, but we did not know what happened. We're in the garret, and we have no windows in this attic of the firehouse, and the firehouse is now a community media center. 9:03, the next plane hit the second tower of the World Trade Center. We were doing, interestingly enough, a show on the significance of September 11th, 1973. Another September 11th. And that was the September 11th when Salvador Allende, the democratically elected leader of Chile, died in the palace as the Pinochet forces rose to power. The U.S.-backed Pinochet forces, backed by then-President Nixon and Secretary of State National Security Advisor Henry Kissinger, Anaconda, ITT, the corporations. And there were more declassified documents that had come out, which was why we were doing the show, further implicating Henry Kissinger. It's very important to put terror in context and to give it history. Yes, on September 11th, 2001, a horrific crime against humanity was committed in New York and also in Washington, D.C. We continued to broadcast those days and didn't leave the firehouse because the Army and the National Guard had moved in and they were clearing everyone out of the area. It was an evacuation zone. We felt it was critical to continue to bring people's voices out, people who had stumbled away from the rubble, trying to make sense of things in this senseless act. And also understanding very well that the war machine was gearing up in Washington and how critical it was to be there from the beginning and broadcast voices like you heard, broadcast the voice of Rita Lazar, the 70-year-old woman who lost her brother, Abe Zalmanowicz, who knew the worst pain of her life and yet saw very quickly what was going to be, how her brother's name and life would be used. As she said, she heard George Bush invoke his name in the National Cathedral address, and she wrote a letter that actually appeared in the New York Times that said that even as she knew the worst pain of her life, that it would not ease her suffering to know that a sister in Afghanistan would lose her brother. She said, not in my brother's name. And a couple named Phyllis and Orlando Rodriguez lost their son, Greg Ernesto Rodriguez. He worked for Cantor Fitzgerald above the 100th floor of the World Trade Center. And as they gathered with their family to remember their son, they also wrote a letter that just swirled around the internet that said, it will not alleviate our suffering to know that soon a mother and father in Afghanistan will know our same anguish, not in our son's name. And a whole movement grew up in New York and around the country called Peaceful Tomorrows, peacefultomorrows.org, of people who had lost loved ones who said, not in our name. Now, we saw over and over again on television family members telling the stories of their loved ones, and that can't be done enough. But when Rita and Phyllis and Orlando and others who were opposed to war wanted to get to the second part of from description to prescription and say, we don't, though, believe that war is the answer, the media would cut away and they would go to the so-called terrorism experts like Oliver North and Henry Kissinger. And they would say, well, Henry Kissinger said even before Bush, we should not only go after the terrorists, but we should bomb the countries that harbor them. And I got nervous because I live in New York and so does Henry Kissinger. But it is so important to understand how September 11th united us at Ground Zero with people around the world, with the people of Chile, thousands died with the rise of the Pinochet regime. When I walked around late at night those first days when all the pictures went up, people put these Xeroxes up of color photographs of their loved ones, a woman with her child, a man holding his cat, and it would say things like, if you have seen my son, please call his mother. He was last seen on the 77th floor of the World Trade Center. Thousands of these Xeroxes of photographs went up all over the city, on telephone poles, on the walls of hospitals, in the parks. And we were all united in that pain. And I thought how similar those pictures were to the pictures carried by the mothers of the Plaza de Mayo in Argentina, as the women would walk, the mothers of the disappeared, holding those pictures, saying, have you seen my son? Have you seen my granddaughter? On September 11th, we were all united with people around the world who've been victims of terror. And all too often, people in other countries have been victims of military regimes that have been supported by the United States. When Bush, it's hard to call him President Bush, right? A man who was not democratically elected in 2000. And we see the terrible repercussions now. A man not popularly elected who has declared war on the world, who is destabilizing the world. But he came to Ground Zero a few days later, and a cry went up around him, USA, USA. And I don't think that's the answer to what happened on September 11th. The answer is a global community united against terror, determined to rout it out everywhere. And there are institutions that are now being set up, like the International Criminal Court, the ICC. And at a time when these international forum to try people who commit crimes against humanity, war crimes, genocide, is being set up, who is the number one force against this? The United States. It started with Clinton, signed on the last day to the International Criminal Court, and then Bush comes into office, takes power, and he unsigns the treaty. And now he just managed to strong-arm the UN Security Council with a number of abstentions, but to pass a resolution that would exonerate or that would exempt U.S. soldiers from being held accountable in the same way as others around the world for another year. Now, what message is being sent from the United States to the rest of the world? They say it's good that there's a tribunal for the Serbs and another one for the Rwandans, but not for us. What kind of message does that send? It sends one that generates a tremendous amount of anger and hostility. We are the number one superpower in the world, and that power should be defined not by military might, but by moral might. And we should be the example of holding those in power accountable. It's these kinds of discussions that people have all over the country and I think all over the world, but they're not broadcast by the mainstream media in our country. And we have to challenge that. We have to show the history. When I talk about Henry Kissinger and say that, yes, I think Osama bin Laden should be tried in an international criminal court and if found guilty, severely punished, and his allies. But I also think Henry Kissinger should be tried in an international criminal court. And if found guilty, he too should be severely punished. And I don't say that lightly. You look at Chile and his deep involvement in the coup that led to thousands of people killed over the 17-year reign of Pinochet. You look at Vietnam and Cambodia and Laos and the millions of people who died and his role with Richard Nixon. And you look at the Indonesian occupation of Timor for a quarter of a century. The Indonesian military, backed by the U.S. government, occupies Timor and commits one of the great genocides of the 20th century. The day before the invasion, December 7, 1975, who goes to Indonesia to give the go-ahead but Secretary of State Henry Kissinger and Gerald Ford, the U.S. president at the time. And they give the green light to Suharto, the long-reigning dictator. And 90% of the weapons used in that invasion were from the United States. These are very serious times, and we have to rout out terror. And it's up to the media to expose these things, to be the check and balance. A few years ago, after I came back from Nigeria with Jeremy Scahill, the producer of Democracy Now!, we did this documentary that was just mentioned called Drilling and Killing, Chevron and Nigeria's Oil Dictatorship, about drilling for oil in the most populous country in Africa. And again, the story of oil being at the root of terrible devastation of lives and what happens in the Niger Delta. And we exposed Chevron's complicity in the murder of two Chevron villagers who were yet again protesting another oil spill. And they went with a bunch of other villagers to a Chevron barge to demand a cleanup and also jobs. And they thought that the Chevron officials were coming to negotiate with them. This was in May 1998. And instead, out of the Chevron helicopters came the Nigerian military and the mobile police, known as the kill and go, the kill and go. And they opened fire on the people, and they killed two of them and critically wounded another and rounded up the others and put them in the notorious Nigerian jails. When we came back, I went to a Chevron shareholders meeting in California on the proxy of the Ursuline Sisters of Tildunk so that I could ask the CEO a question. I don't make it a habit of wearing habits, but on that day, I felt it was important to be able to ask that question. And so I got up during the Q&A period where shareholders were allowed to address the well-protected CEO at the time named Ken Durr, and I asked if he would stop Chevron's practice of killing, allowing the Nigerian military to kill protesters on their sites. And he said, no, that's a ridiculous question. Next. He said, no, they wouldn't stop. It was a ridiculous question. And he moved on. That should be front page news. Of course, if people, environmentalists, protested Chevron in the United States, if they dared to have them killed, it would be a big story. But these corporations can do this hand in hand with the racism of the media, knowing that they will not shed a spotlight in places like the Niger Delta, so they can get away with it. Anyway, we did this documentary, and because we had the Chevron officials on tape from Nigeria saying that they had brought in the military, and we basically caught them red-handed, actually boasting about having done this, we won some awards in the United States, and one of them was the Overseas Press Club Award, a citation from the Overseas Press Club. So Jeremy and I went over to the dinner to get the citation, this big black tie affair. We actually were not going to go because it cost $125 a plate to get into the event. And we couldn't afford that, but they said we could stand at the back and we could come forward when they announced the awards. We also weren't going to go because it was the middle of the bombing of Yugoslavia and we had a lot of work to do, but we couldn't resist because Tom Brokaw was the MC, the master of ceremonies, and we thought this is a fantastic opportunity. He will say, drilling and killing Chevron and Nigeria's oil dictatorship. And we will get that on tape, and maybe we'll replace us saying it in the documentary with him, and people would find it more believable. So we thought this was not an opportunity to be missed. So we went to the event, we stood at the back of the room, and the ceremony began. An official of the Overseas Press Club got up, and he said, I want to welcome you all to this very important dinner, to honor the finest in journalism. We're going to have dinner, and then we will have the award ceremony. But I just want to say, while journalists face serious danger all over the world, he said, there are rays of hope. This was 1999. There are rays of hope. For example, the Indonesian government is treating journalists much better now. And so enjoy your dinner, and we will be back. So I was at the back of the room. I'd been covering Indonesia and East Timor for many years. This was the spring of 1999. And you know what happened through the spring and summer before the referendum where the Timorese voted for their independence. The Indonesian military burned East Timor to the ground. They set up these militias in Timor and they ransacked the country. And this was happening just that week. They had gone in and massacred another group of people and terrorized journalists, threatening to kill them. This was even reported in the New York Times, which was very rare for the Times to do. I thought he was kidding. And I thought he was going to get back up and say, no, quite seriously, this is why we're here tonight, is to cover these kind, to honor those who cover these kind of issues. But no, he sat down to enjoy his champagne and filet mignon. So I went over, beware of hungry journalists, I had nothing else to do, and said to him, sir, the Indonesian government is not treating journalists well, and it never has. It beats them. It bans them. It kills them. And I said, what makes you think that they're improving their treatment? And he said, because I wrote a letter to the foreign ministry and they wrote back and they said that. So I said, well, I have information to the contrary. And he said, why don't you fax it to me and I'll look it over. Now, this was a journalist. He refused to go back up on the stage to correct what he had said. So we just stood back and saw that Richard Holbrooke was making his way out of the ballroom. Richard Holbrooke was going to be the honored speaker that night. He was about to become the U.S. ambassador to the United Nations. And, you know, this is something I have a long-term problem with, is the revolving door between journalists and politicians and the journalists honoring politicians, right, to gain access. What are they doing honoring Richard Holbrooke? So he was going off to the bathroom, so Jeremy and I ran over to ask him some questions. He was the trigger man for the bombing of Yugoslavia. He was the person who delivered the Rambouillet Accord to Milosevic, who rejected it, and the bombs started to fall, so we thought we'd ask him a few questions about that. He refused to answer, which is his right. Most politicians do. But what disturbed us is that the head of the Overseas Press Club came over to us and said, what do you think you're doing? aside from not eating, we said we were asking Mr. Holbrook a question, and said, no, we have agreed that we will not ask him questions tonight. He would not have come if we were going to ask him questions. I said, well, he shouldn't be here to begin with. But that's my job. I think that's what you're supposed to be honoring tonight, the finest in journalism. It starts with asking questions, especially in a time of war. She went off, and we continued to stand there until Holbrook then gave his address. He was introduced by a producer from NBC who said, what can I say about Dick, she said. She said, he's here, he's there, he's everywhere. She said, he may be a tiger on the world stage, but he's a pussycat at home with his wife, Cottie, who is Cottie Martin, who was formerly married to Peter Jennings. And she said, I am presenting to you the man who we all hope will become the next U.S. ambassador to the United Nations, Richard Holbrook. And he got up and congratulated each network by name to say, I really want to applaud your reporters in Yugoslavia. You already know them. There's trouble. And when they come back to Washington, we'll let them know how proud we are of them and how they are doing the reporting. So he then went on to give a major foreign policy address where he said he had just learned that the U.S. and NATO forces had bombed RTS, Radio Television Serbia, off the air. He basically announced a war crime because that is a civilian target. He said, I learned it on CNN. Everyone believes what they hear on CNN, and so people tittered and laughed, and he went on. We went back to the office to see people's body parts being pulled out of Radio Television Serbia. You know, the cosmetologists and the technicians, the people who worked in this facility. He then went on to talk about whether there would be ground troops, and that was the end of it. Jeremy walked up as people were clapping. He said, Mr. Holbrook, a question from the press. And he turned to Brokaw and Leslie Stahl and said to them, I hope you will support me in asking this question. He asked a question about the Rambouillet Accord and wasn't the bar set too high, knowing Milosevic would reject it and that would provide the pretext for the bombing. Brokaw jumped up and said, you be quiet, you sit down, and then called security to have Jeremy taken out. So he's being taken out by security, and I'm standing at the back. I said, release that man. He's just about to win an award. And so they were a little confused, but they did release him. And the ceremony began. And it began with another official of the Overseas Press Club saying, how do I introduce Tom Brokaw to you? But to say, you know, you get the measure of a man when you sit with him for a long time. And in 1975, this official said, I had the opportunity to sit with Tom Brokaw for some 17 hours on Henry Kissinger's plane when he was coming back from Asia. And I could only think 1975 was Kissinger going to Indonesia, gave the go-ahead for the invasion, and flew back to the United States. His State Department officials desperately cabling him to say that the Indonesian occupation, the invasion of Timor, is terribly bloody. It's not going to be able to be justified. Congress will want to cut off aid. And he got back to Washington, called together the high-level State Department officials, and castigated them for, quote, leaving a paper trail, and said, we will not kick our ally in the teeth. And that led to one of the great genocides of the 20th century. So anyway, this guy said, sat with him for 17 hours, really learned about him, and occasionally we would get up and have canapes in the front of the plane with Kissinger and then sit back down. I mean, the whole thing was just a caricature. And then he introduced Tom Brokaw, who began the ceremony. And he gave out this award, and that it was the Pepsi-Cola Award for Good Reporting, the Merrill Lynch Award for Good Business Reporting. Truly, it's you hear Overseas Press Club Award, but it's divided into those. God forbid you would have a union sponsoring that they would allow, because that would be a conflict of interest. But I think it was the full Fortune 500. It wasn't 400 awards, but of the corporations giving journalists their awards. And then he came to us, and said, and he would name the piece, and then the people would come up. And so he said, and now this goes to Amy Goodman and Jeremy Scahill for Nigeria's oil dictatorship. Well, so that was the final straw. So I came up and I said, repeat after me, it's drilling and killing, Chevron, and Nigeria's oil dictatorship. But I said, I'm Amy Goodman, and that's Jeremy Scahill, who you had security take out of the room. I want to thank you for the award, but no thank you. We can't accept an award tonight for two reasons. One is because this ceremony began by congratulating the Indonesian military regime, which has beat and banned and killed journalists for many years. And second, because you're honoring a politician tonight who is a trigger man for the bombing of Yugoslavia. And we're not here to applaud politicians. We're here to challenge them. So thank you, but no thank you. And I got off the stage, and Tom Brokaw got up and said, it's a great country. It's a great country. It's a great First Amendment that we have. And now, Pacifica permitting, we will move on with the ceremonies tonight. And he went on, and they gave out, and the last award was the Merrill Lynch Award for Good Reporting, and they gave that actually to Business Week. And they gave it, and that ended the ceremony, and a guy in tails came up to me after to introduce himself, and he was an editor at Business Week. And I had known him because a few months before, Business Week did an amazing report called What Mobile Knew. And it was a picture of a man holding a skull, and it was about Aceh, which is a very serious situation right now in Indonesia. ExxonMobil has the largest gas field in the world there, and the Indonesian military continues to kill the people there, has killed thousands over the years. But it was a piece alleging that ExxonMobil had, at the time Mobil, had given excavating equipment to the Indonesian military to dig mass graves to put the bodies of the workers in. It was an amazing piece, and every once in a while the corporate media does something that is remarkable. The question is there an echo? Is there follow-up? But we had wanted to have them on Democracy Now!, the editors and reporters, and they wanted to come on, but in the end Business Week vetoed it and said, no, they can't talk about it. So they could publish it, but not say more about it. They were afraid of a lawsuit. So anyway, he came up to me. I talked to him on the phone, never met him, and he said, you know, I'm that person. I'm the editor. So I said, well, what are you doing here? And he said, well, we just won the award for that piece, the Merrill Lynch Award. And I said, really? But Tom Brokaw named the titles of all the pieces except ours, of course, but for you, he just said, for your reporting on Indonesia. And he said, that's right. It was called What Mobil Knew. Because Tom Brokaw was feeling probably a little nervous about having called security on us, and it was sort of hearkening back to a little controversy around him a few weeks before, where he had just come out with his book, I think it was The Greatest Generation, and he was interviewed on the Today Show, where he used to be the anchor, and I think it was Katie Couric or Jane Pauley at the time who had said to him, how does it feel, Tom, to come back to your old haunt? And he said, well, I got up at 3:30 in the morning, I walked over and I looked at those homeless people sleeping in the street, and I was envious of them, thinking they got an hour more sleep than I did. So that had gotten a little titter, and I think he thought this was also going to get sort of some uncomfortable coverage now. So he said that Richard Holbrooke had agreed that he would do an interview with us. When we went up to Richard Holbrooke after, he told us to get lost, and Leslie Stahl was standing next to him and said, Dick, I'll take you home. So we went over to Brokaw, said he was not going to do an interview, and Brokaw left. So I ran up to Frank Sesno of CNN, and I said to him, and this is a great opportunity to talk to other reporters, what do you think of your network and all the network's policies of putting generals on the payroll? Yet you don't pay peace activists to come in. You don't even allow them to come in for free. But why pay these generals? You can get the Pentagon's point of view for free. Instead, you get this 24-hour commentary, which is, again, a drumbeat for war. And he said, well, we've actually talked about that idea, that notion, but we've decided against it, having peace activists in. So I said, well, why is that? He said, well, because the generals are analysts and the peace activists are advocates. Generals are analysts and the peace activists are advocates. I'm still going to an analyst over that one. But I said, would you consider interviewing someone like Noam Chomsky? And he said, I don't know him personally. And you see how it works. That revolving door, who they socialize with. He's sitting with Richard Holbrooke having dinner. He knows him personally, and so, you know, he'll have him in. Well, this has to be challenged, this cozy relationship that the media has with the corporations. The next day, there was a page six piece in the New York Post. That's the gossip page of the gossip rag of New York. And it said, it was a whole piece of what had happened. And it's the headline was, Brokaw shushes Kosovo crank. So Jeremy looked at it, and he said, I didn't see Brokaw tell Holbrooke to be quiet. But in the piece, it actually accurately described everything that happened, and Leslie Stahl did talk to the New York Post. They asked her, what did they think of the issues we had raised? And she said, it wasn't the time or place. And my response is, what is a better time or place than being in the midst of the bombing of Yugoslavia with hundreds of journalists gathered to talk about and to honor the finest in journalism? My moral of the story that I took from that is Tom broke all the rules of good reporting. Leslie stalled and Frank says no to fine journalism. But these guys have to be challenged in a very systematic way. And the best way to do that is not only to critique them, but to create our own media. I mean, it's how in our country, in the United States, Timor got known through Pacifica Radio, the constant coverage of that genocide. Here in Canada, in fact, the last time I was here was soon after the massacre of 1991 when peace groups had, at the Canadian Parliament, there was a session where we spoke, and now the foreign minister of Timor, José Ramos Horta, who was then a man who was not able to return to his country, testified about what had happened. You know the story of Timor, and I'll just ending with connecting these kinds of critical stories of our day to why we need a people's media that will report those stories, give a forum to the voices of those who have suffered all over the world. The Indonesian military attacks East Timor in 1975, kills a third of the population, closed the country to the outside world for more than a decade. And then because of international pressure in 1989 and 1990, was forced to open East Timor, a crack. And some people were able to get in, and I went there with Alan Nairn, a journalist who was reporting for the New Yorker magazine at the time. We went there in 1990 and found this absolute hell on earth. The people who were letting us know about it were people like Elaine Briere here in Canada of the East Timor Alert Network, did incredible work over those years, bringing us the photographs, bringing us the stories of what was happening in Timor, doing the work that the major media should have been doing all over the world. And we went back in 1991 when a Portuguese parliamentary delegation was supposed to go to Timor and for the first time engage in a fact-finding mission to let us know, the world know, what was happening there. Timor had been occupied by Portugal for more than 400 years, and then Indonesia invaded. So we went to see what was going to happen in those fateful days of 1991. And we got there at the end of October, went to the main Catholic church in Dili, the capital of East Timor. And when we went to Mass there, the women were crying. We didn't know if it was just the standard sorrow of Timor or if something terrible had just happened. And we learned after the Mass that the Indonesian military had surrounded the church the night before and shot into it and killed a young man at point-blank range named Sebastio Gomez. And so the next day, there was a funeral for him led by Bishop Bello, who later won the Nobel Peace Prize, along with José Ramos Horta. And 1,000 people turned out to honor this young man, to go to the church, and then to march through the streets of Dili to the cemetery. It was the largest act of civil disobedience the military had ever seen. That's simply people walking through the streets. And they marched to the cemetery, put up their hands in the V-sign, and they buried Sebastio Gomez. We went around the country then for 2 weeks to see how the military was preparing for the delegation. And everywhere we heard the same story. The military told the people, if you speak to the delegation, we'll kill you after they leave. We'll kill your family to the seventh generation, was the line most commonly used. A nationwide death threat had been issued. And then came the morning of November 12, 1991. By then, we had learned that the delegation was not going to come. We later learned it was at the behest of the United States, because for the first time, word would get out about what's happening inside the country. We went to the Motayal Church, where a mass was held, and this time, 2 weeks later, there was a commemoration mass for Sebastio Gomez, and more than 1,000 people turned out. And this time, when they walked through the streets of Dili, the kids unfurled banners pulled out from their Catholic school blouses that said things like, why the Indonesian military shoot our church, and they pleaded with President Bush at the time in the UN to do something, because now that the delegation wasn't going to come, all the people who'd taken refuge in the churches so that they could speak and wouldn't be arrested before they came had no protection. And they marched through the streets, through this geography of pain, every other building, military barracks or police barracks or even the hotels where Timorese were held at the back and tortured. And they marched, and people came from all sectors of society, from workplaces, from home, and they gathered. Thousands of people marched to the cemetery. And when they got to the cemetery, it was about 8 o'clock in the morning. And we were talking to people, you know, why are you doing this? You know, the Indonesian military had lined the route. You're risking your lives. And they said, I'm doing it for my mother. I'm doing it for my father. I'm doing it for freedom. And then we saw from the same direction the Timorese had come, the Indonesian military marching up with their USM-16s at the ready position, hundreds of them. The crowd got very quiet. They couldn't get away because there were high walls on either side of the road, and the soldiers were marching up 10 to 12 abreast. Alan and I decided to walk to the front of the crowd, thinking maybe the presence of Western journalists could head off this, what looked clearly like an attack. And this time we took all of our equipment out. We'd always hid it before, but now we took it out. We thought that this, for the first time, could protect the people. And I held up my microphone, and Alan put the camera above his head, and we walked to the front of the crowd. There was another Westerner there, or another person from Australia named Kamal Bamadhaj. His sister, Lillian Gibbons, spoke often about Timor over these past years. She lived in Canada. And Kamal stayed back in the crowd, and he had his camera. The Indonesian military marched up, and without any warning, without any provocation, without any hesitation, they opened fire on the crowd. And the first to go down were the young people right behind us, like 7 and 8 years old, just exploding from the gunfire. And they just kept on shooting them. They threw me to the ground and beat me, and then Alan got a photograph of them opening fire, and then he threw himself on top of me to protect me from further injury, and they took their USM-16s like baseball bats, and they slammed them against his skull until they fractured it. And so we lay in the road. He was covered in blood, and they lined up in a firing squad fashion, about 10, 12 of them, and they were putting the guns to our heads, and they were screaming, politique, politique, because to witness this was political. And they were also asking, are we from Australia, Australia? Because in 1975, when Indonesia first invaded, there were 5 journalists who were covering the events for Australian Broadcasting Corporation. And they lined them up against a house and executed them. And the 6th journalist who covered on the day of the invasion, 75, Roger East from Australia, he was in a radio station in Dili, and they dragged him out. And along with thousands of Timorese, they shot him into the harbor as he shouted, I'm from Australia. But Australia did nothing about the killing of those journalists. Well, I think we know why. A few years later, the foreign minister of Australia went into a helicopter with the foreign minister of Indonesia, and they signed the Timor Gap Treaty, which is where they would divide up the oil spoils in the Timor Gap between Australia and Indonesia. It was Timor's oil. Oil driving so much of what we see that is so harmful in the world. But Australia hardly protested. So for them to ask if we're from Australia, we understood the consequences of this. And I shouted, no, we're from America. And they had stripped us of everything, but I still had my passport and I threw it at them. And they would kick me in the stomach when I'd get my breath back. I'd say, America, America. And at some point, they decided to take the guns from our heads. I think because we were from the same country their weapons were from, and they would have to pay a price for us that they had never had to pay for killing the Timorese. They went on and they continued killing that day. A Red Cross Jeep pulled up. We were able to get into it. An old Timorese man, the military had dragged into a sewer ditch behind us. And every time he put up his hands in the prayer sign, they would smash his face with the butts of their rifles. The Red Cross picked him up and carried him into the front of the Jeep. And we drove off. And then dozens of Timorese hailed down the Jeep and jumped on top of us and all on top of the vehicle and hanging off the spare tire at the back, and we drove like that as a human mass to the hospital. We left the hospital because although Alan was in serious shape, I really felt the military was going to raid the hospital, and there was clearly no way we could stop these killings at this point except to get out of the country and report to the outside world. The pressure wouldn't come from inside. We went into hiding in two places, and then made our way to the airport, to the one plane out that day. And they had already surrounded our hotel. We couldn't get anything. And the only thing we could do, we had gone to the bishop's house, Bishop Bellow, and he helped clean Alan up as thousands of Timorese were coming into the compound seeking refuge. And I took Alan's shirt, which was covered in blood, and wrapped it under a towel around my waist and thought, I know they're going to deny that anything took place, as they always had, and as the world press had dutifully reported. But if we have some kind of evidence, even what had happened to us. So I wrapped his shirt under this towel. We went to the airport, and somehow we were able to get on this last plane, though the Indonesian military at first stopped us. And whether it was a gap in communication with the military at the massacre site, or they had decided consciously not to kill us at this point and then just wanted us out, we were able to fly out of the country. We flew from east to west Timor, then to Bali, and got on the phone and called the United States and said there had been a massacre. Got on the plane, came to the United States, held a press conference at the National Press Club, and it was packed with all of the cameras from the main networks. None of them reported the story, and particularly that the U.S. weapons were used. It was reported in the print press until 10 days later, when a videotape got out of Timor. There was another reporter at the scene of the massacre from Yorkshire TV in Britain, and he was inside the cemetery. When the soldiers opened fire, he thought it was firecrackers, but then realized what had happened because people were running through the cemetery, young people, as fast as they could through the cemetery as there was gunfire outside. And he started to film, and he would dig the videotape in a fresh grave every 10 minutes, knowing he would probably be arrested. And the videotape is unbelievable because even when you see that young people, if they run at top speed, they could make their way through the cemetery and then run up into the mountains. When one of their friends or family members was shot, others would stop and hold them, knowing that they then would be taken or shot or tortured, but not wanting their loved ones to die alone. And Max Stahl is the filmmaker. He got one person who was laying there as his friend held him and cradled him, and his guts were falling out. And they said, show this to the world. And what matters is when the media is there with a spotlight to show these atrocities, because then there's no question people around the world will care, but it's our responsibility to be there. That videotape did get out of the country, and it was shown in Britain and in Japan and Holland. And in Britain, there was such a tremendous response that the CBS correspondent called Dan Rather, CBS Evening News, said, you've got to air this. This is 10 days after. He said, because of the response of the British public. That was now the news hook. And so they did air it, 2 minutes, just showing this footage of the terrible atrocities that were being committed. And this was not one of the larger massacres in Timor. That was 1991. A worldwide movement grew up after the massacre and in the United States to press for the end of the arming of the Indonesian regime. Then the referendum took place in 1999. Indonesia burned East Timor to the ground, but the people of East Timor had their say. And even if it was their last act and Alan had gotten in, we were banned for ever returning to Indonesia or East Timor at the time. We'd gotten back in 94, 3 years later, and we were arrested and held by the Indonesian military. And then Alan got back in 1999. I was deported twice to cover the referendum. The military caught me, but not him. And he reported how... And his reports came out daily on Democracy Now! Just as the country was being destroyed, so that people around the world could not deny that we at least we knew what was happening. And then it's our responsibility. But if you don't know, then you can't do anything about it. But if you do know, then we have a responsibility. And Alan reported as an old woman was taken to the voting booth on a stretcher, because this would be her last act, and she said to vote for the freedom of her people. He said to a young man who had, it was dark, this was in 1999, at the end of the day of voting, how come you're out? It's the time of curfew. And he said, I voted. It doesn't matter anymore. Just a remarkable resistance that the Timorese showed for 25 years. And I'll just end by saying that while all of the things we see today, the invasion of Iraq, more civilians killed in Iraq today than were killed at the World Trade Center, why? Is that how we respond to terror with terror? There are good things, too. If you go in the United States to Illinois to visit the death row there, there are no people on death row because they've abolished it in this one state, Illinois, which has a conservative Republican governor who ran the campaign for Bush and his state. But because of grassroots activists for many years fighting against the death penalty, because of mothers of men on death row who never gave up the struggle to exonerate their sons, and one by one they were freed, and because of that grassroots activism being covered by the Chicago Tribune in a series of pieces, the governor realized there's something terribly wrong. He was not opposed to the death penalty, but he was opposed to people. He was opposed to signing death warrants for men that he understood might not be guilty, and he could not take that on himself. And so he called for a moratorium. That's absolutely remarkable. I'm hopeful because in Tulia, Texas, just a few days ago, 12 African Americans were released from jail after an outrageous drug sting that took place several years ago by one white undercover cop. And if you listen to Democracy Now!, you've heard the story. Absolutely unbelievable. He had 10% of the black population arrested in a town on completely trumped-up charges. But because of grassroots activism and people hearing about this story, those people are now being freed one by one, and that man, that undercover agent, Tom Coleman himself, has been indicted. And I'm hopeful because of East Timor. I mean, the people of East Timor have paid an unbelievably high price for their freedom. But on May 20th, 2002, Alan Nairn and I went back to Timor and had the humbling and awesome experience of being able to stand with 100,000 Timorese, between 100,000 and 200,000, the number who died over the last 25 years. But here these people were representing all of those, standing in a sandy field outside of Dili, as Kofi Annan addressed the country, and then Xanana Gusmao, the rebel leader of East Timor, who became the president, the founding president of East Timor, raised the flag of the Democratic Republic of East Timor. And this nation of survivors wept and celebrated. Yes, with resistance and with determination and persistence, what Margaret Mead says is really true. The whole idea that that whole quote that actually was just the theme of a graduation I spoke at last week at Evergreen State College in Olympia, Washington, the graduation that Rachel Corrie should have been at, the young woman who died in Rafah, Gaza, because she was bearing witness and she was run over by an Israeli military bulldozer. She was crushed. The graduation she should have attended because it was hers, along with all of the other students at Olympia. And they honored Rachel on that day just last week. And the theme of their graduation was Margaret Mead's quote, "Never doubt for a moment that a small group of committed, thoughtful people can make a difference. Indeed, it's the only thing that ever has." So keep up your great work. Support community media. Demand that media fulfill its fundamental obligation, and that is to serve a democratic society, to go to where the silence is and say something. Thank you very much.